a house buying business has a lot of moving parts, and you got to really know your numbers. You got to know how you're going to finance it. You're going to know how you're going to pay for that financing, especially flipping the properties. We'd take on a good amount of debt in hopes that we'd sell it for more.
Real estate is about freedom, choice freedom, time freedom, and money freedom, and the impact you can make with that freedom. But it doesn't come without cost. Your freedom takes work. That's why Neil Timmons brings together the tools you need to build your real estate legacy, from tips and tricks to interviews with industry titans. It's all here in one place. Real Grit. Let's get to it.
Hey, welcome to Real Grit. I got Travis Baucom here with me. I'm excited to talk to him. Travis, how are you?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to it.
I'm glad to have you here. Say, we all got started in real estate. How in the world did you enter into this industry?
Actually, I had a job selling insulation, like fiberglass insulation in 2009. And instead of getting fired in the construction industry, I kept that job. But my boss was like, you got to go find every possible job out there. And so I discovered a whole bunch of house flippers flipping houses. I ended up taking them out to lunch on the company's dime, going, how do you do this? How do you buy in things? How are you doing this? They led me to read a whole bunch of books. And those books, read some other books, and then didn't really do anything for 2 or 3 years. And then my first house I bought was a HUD home, and I ended up buying it. I had rented it out before my mortgage was due, which is good because I didn't really have any more money. I didn't have the money to pay for the mortgage. So the tenants paid it, thankfully. And that was kind of how we got started. My wife was a little nervous at the time, but then she ended up bragging to her mom about what I did. And she was just kind of let me take the reins, and we ended up buying tons of houses over it.
So you ended up buying a bunch of houses. And what time period was that?
So I bought my first house in August of 2012. And then we bought houses up until 2018. From 2015 to 2018, we ended up buying the bulk majority of our houses, and it ended up being about 357 houses. Not about, that's exactly how many
I was going to say, not about, it's pretty specific. Yeah.
And then before 2015, and then after 2018, that's where the other 50 came in. But we've collectively bought over 400 houses over the last 10 years. And yeah, so we can extrapolate on that.
What did you learn through the process of buying all of those?
A house buying business has a lot of moving parts. And you got to really know your numbers. You got to know how you're going to finance it. You're going to know how you're going to pay for that financing, especially when you were doing what we were doing, which is flipping the properties. We'd take on a good amount of debt in hopes that we'd sell it for more. Take anywhere from 3 to 9 months to do that. You have to have the capital set aside to make sure you can make that work. A lot of times you're kind of hoping that the house, your old project sells before the next one, the mortgage gets due on the other one. So that's the cluster of trying to make a high volume house buying business is not for the faint of heart. You have to have a lot of people working for you, a lot of payroll, a lot of operational procedures, that sort of thing. And then it's still a toss up if you're going to be profitable.
Did you keep any of them, or it was just straight flipping?
Well, so what happened is we accumulated 72 houses for rental properties by October 2018. That year, our goal, when we set our goals in December of 2017 for 2018, our goal was to buy 175 houses. We got to 91 houses, and essentially, we ran out of money. Like, we had a ton of equity, we had a ton of opportunity, but we were not able to get rid of those houses fast enough. And then to take the nut of the $70,000, $80,000 a month of payroll and marketing and interest-only payments and that sort of thing basically sunk us. And so even though we had 72 houses, I spent after that, when that happened, I had to fire everybody and I had to take my staff. I mean, I had to take all my files and all the spreadsheets, had to go back to my house and my little bitty tiny office at my house and spend the next 2 years unwinding everything. We had 42 renovations going at that time. I had 72 rentals. Property manager was stealing money from us. Even if he wasn't, they weren't really making money. It was a pretty big disaster.
It seems like, and what doesn't get talked about a lot, the house flipping business is a cash monster.
100%. Yeah. It's the tangible asset day trading, in my opinion. Like, you're hoping that something will sell for more. You have good data that it will, but there's so many other outside mechanisms that can keep that from happening outside of just economic environment, essentially hoping that someone goes into your house, has an emotional experience and goes, okay, I'll buy this one. I like the way the kitchen it looks. I like the way the bedroom looks. The bathrooms are great. I can see my kids walking around the living room. Okay, yeah, I'll buy this one. It fits in my budget. It is a financial transaction for them, but it's mostly an emotional transaction, especially first-time house buyers, which is what we kind of specialize.
Yeah.
The assets we were selling were the 250 and below type price points. The market we are in is a pretty cheap market. So a 250 grand is like used to be a pretty expensive house.
Yeah. All right. Then you spent 2 years unwinding everything. What did that look like?
It was tough. Pretty much any form of resistance or trials or stress, I was probably handling it. Like I said, we had half the, where I live in Waco, Texas. There's a famous building called the Alico Building. You can Google it and see how pretty it is. It was built, it was actually at one point the tallest building east of the, or west of the Mississippi. We had half the 12th floor of that building. And it was great. We could bring a private investor, someone who wanted to like lend us money, and they would just see all the stuff we have. They'd see the views we have, and it was an easy sell. But I had to terminate that lease. Thankfully, they let me out of it. And then I brought everything home. We had to get rid of, like, I think they kept 8 desks. Like, I just like, y'all can keep them. Y'all can use it for the next people wanting to move in or sell them. And that could be part of my rent. You know, it was a tough time. It was primarily the first few months were the toughest because we were bleeding cash like nobody's business. I essentially had every minute of my schedule every week. You know, we had 5 crews. We were trying to knock 42 renovations out that were all over the place. Sometimes houses like 5 to 8 hours away. Texas is a big state. Yeah. We were buying, if we could find a deal, we were buying it regardless if we knew how to. Is a terrible idea, but we would buy it regardless if we had crews that could finish it. We were like, we'll just aim first and shoot first and aim second, basically. Yeah. That's a good recipe for a complete disaster.
Sure.
So, but yeah, we got real tight on money personally and professionally. And thankfully, we had some really good banking relationships. None of our private investors or our bankers ever took a hickey. They got paid their interest payments. They got paid all of that stuff as I had committed and agreed to when I signed the loan agreements. It just came out a little differently than, you know, we all had hoped. So, sure.
All right. So fast forward 2 years. You dig yourself. You're out of the hole. Now what?
Well, so right when the whole kind of began, I was like, all right, what is working in my business? We had a lot of short-term rentals that were really doing well. That was before Airbnb kind of took off. It was pre-pandemic. It was still kind of like a very wild west of an asset class. No bank was really excited to lend on it. We had a bank that was willing to lend on it. We bought up a whole bunch of lots before everything fell apart, all in a really strategic area of the town I live in. We were essentially trying to move towards that primarily because I had set some principles in my life when everything fell apart that if I'm going to invest in something, it needs to be making money every day, every week, or every month. And short-term rentals at the time or Airbnbs at the time, or in general, do that. They make money every day or every week or every month. So it sounded like a great idea. We had 7 of them at the time. We converted 4 of our rental properties to Airbnb. So we had a total of 11 and we were doing well. I'd flip a house, pay a banker, flip another house, pay a private lender, you know, and we get through that. And then halfway through that, October 2018, March 2020 comes. I'm almost out of it. We have 11 houses left out of the 103 or however many, you know, 72 plus 42 renovations. And we all know the pandemic hit. And like, I watched $81,000 of booked earnings for 2 months just literally go from $81,000 to $0. And I just remember being on my back patio being like, I don't think I can get out of this one. I just got out of the 2018 one. And so because of the situation I was in, I was talking to my banker quite a bit. And he's like, just keep talking to us. We're going to make sure you get out of this. And so as I was navigating that situation, I realized that short-term rentals, or another way to say them, hospitality assets are great cash flow assets. They $1,000, $2,000, sometimes $3,000 or $4,000 net cash flow per house every month. That's really great. But when there's a pandemic or a slowdown or whatever, that is the first asset. If you look at hotels and like lodging, that is the first asset to crash. The last asset to crash, if it even crashes, is self-storage and industrial. So I texted a buddy of mine who is well-connected. He's been podcasting for over 10 years. And I was like, who do I need to know that's in the self-storage space? He referred 2 people to me and I called those guys. One of them owned a book. I then went to Amazon and bought all the other books. There was like 3 books. There's not a lot of books on self-storage.
Right.
And I read all of those and I was like, I think this would be a good hedge. I was still in love with the Airbnbs, even though we had just gotten pummeled. And I was like, but I think I can hedge with storage. And if I have Airbnb, short-term rentals, and then storage, that's a good way to make sure that I'm never going to experience what I just experienced over the last 2 years.
Yeah. Wow. All right. You're going to deep dive into self-storage. What do you do then?
After reading all the books, I started driving around. We were all my family, my kids, my wife, 2,000 square foot house. I was getting kind of cabin fever. So I just jumped in a truck, drove to all the outskirts towns of Waco, and I just wrote down storage addresses, names, et cetera, et cetera. And then I started sending them letters. And I thought I was going to, by the end of this, I'll have four or five of these. And no one called me. Zero people called me. Then I was like, well, I'll just try in Waco. I called every owner in Waco and no one wanted to sell. And I was like, okay, no one's wanting to sell these suckers. Why?
It's a sign.
Why are people not wanting to sell these facilities? And I was like, this has got to be something really good or like just something I don't know yet. And so that's essentially what I did. And then slowly I grew a relationship with brokers, that sort of thing. I was still doing the Airbnb thing. I was still flipping a house occasionally just because we needed to live on the income. Yeah. And then at the end, I think it was late 2020 is when I bought my first facility. And now I know why people don't like to sell these things. So compared to the house flipping business, where any given day you have 7, 8, 9, 10 things go wrong, trying to find a plumber at 123 Main Street and trying to find an electrician at the one across the street or, you know, on the other side of town, like it's impossible. Whereas storage, it's like everyone is paying such a little amount. And one of the strategies is to get them to pay through ACH or credit card, like the auto debit. They don't even think about it. If they're paying $35 to $130 a month, that's almost like a gym membership. The whole reason Crunch Fitness and Planet Fitness and all those other gyms do so well, they can have 7,500 members, but you go into a Crunch Fitness and there's 30 people in there. Right. It's because people have forgotten that they had it or they actually ended up needing it for a long time. And so, yeah, it's been great. It's one of the lowest operating cost businesses I've owned. And then it's just like the comment you made, it is kind of like a set it and forget it in a sense. Like I spend about 10 to 20 minutes on a week on each facility. We have 7 now. So it's just not a lot. There's other things, you know, we're building one that's taking a lot of my time. We have several other projects that we're dealing with. But when it comes to storage, it's just real laid back and everyone's just real. Every facility I bought, it's always been a man who's at least in his 70s wearing overalls at the closing table. It's always, you know, he's just been enjoying a relaxing life. And now some kid wants to pay him way too much for his facility. And so,
have you been to the vault? RealGritVault.com. Listen, we've got multiple guests who come on and oftentimes they bring us little tips, tricks, tools, scripts, Excel calculators, a multitude of things, and they share it. They share it for you. You can get them totally free. RealGritVault.com. Never been on the show who's brought everything. It's all behind the vault. Get it. RealGritVault.com.
So he does. Yeah. All right. So I want to touch on a couple of things or ask about a couple of things inside of that asset class of self-storage. Let's start first before we get into the management side. How do you find these things? So on the front end of this, the funnel, if you will, how do you find these things that you bought?
Yeah. So every facility I bought right now was either on the market or it was about to be on the market, and a broker is how I connect with them. So after I had sold or in the middle of the process of selling everything, I reached out to brokers like, hey, I just sold 72 single family rentals. We're done with that asset class and we're looking at putting it in storage. I need help on figuring out how to underwrite this thing. Can you help me? So it's if going from a sales perspective, that was a rescue technique. I'm going, hey, can you please help me here? And then everybody is wanting to help somebody because it gives them significance. And by doing that, what I did is I showed that I was a veteran. I knew what I was doing. I had just sold 72 properties and I needed their help. I was going to put my money in the asset class that they specialize in and then I need their help. And so by doing that, I've created quite a bit of relationship capital, meaning like people that have deals that either about to be on the market or are on the market, when calling those guys, like, you know, with the phone call, they tend to be pretty open about like, well, we feel like this is going to happen and this is going to happen. And this is kind of where we think this is moving. That's been great. There are a lot of people, or there's a handful of people that do off market asset purchases. Like basically they reach out, they send letters, but I had that with the house flipping business. And I'm really trying to, I don't want that anymore. I don't want to have a whole sales staff trying to. Maybe at one point we'll get that going. But right now, I'm thoroughly enjoying just being able to find deals through brokers. The difference between self-storage assets that are listed through brokers and, say, an apartment complex or triple net retail center is it's a really, really small business. Like, it's a very small industry. They're a little bit more forthright in the numbers. They're a little bit more honest. They realize that it's not. With an apartment complex, there's a lot of ambiguity. So you put countertops in, you get $200 a unit, or do you only get $100 a unit? Well, we're talking about metal and concrete. There's not much you can do. You can raise rents and then you can expand and maybe in paint, put up a fence, run the operations remotely to save money. It's much more of a purchasing a business as opposed to purchasing like a real estate asset, like an apartment would be.
Yeah. How do you manage them?
So five of them are in the same town of a little town called Coleman, Texas, and one of the sweetest ladies ever. My original plan was to run it through a call center, but after meeting my manager, once I bought it, like, she knew every single unit, who the person was, what they did, if they paid on time. And I was like, I can't get rid of her. At the time, she was just a little bit more than the call center was going to be. So I was like, I'm going to stick here with her at least for a year. And, you know, we've had it for 2 years now. And she'll run it as long until she tells me she doesn't want to.
Yeah.
And then the other two, a little bit bigger, one's in Oklahoma City, and then one's in Waxahachie, Texas. Those are ran by a call center out of Illinois. So you call the number, it goes to a phone tree, mm-hmm. live answer to one of five call center employees.
Agents there. Yeah, yeah. All right. So totally remote. Nobody's on site there.
We do have facility managers as needed. Mm-hmm. So we pay them $50 an hour when we need them. So typically rents are due on the 1st, they're late on the 5th. So on the 6th, they're showing up to put red locks on or overlocks. That way the tenant wants their stuff, they're forced to pay us to get rid of that lock. And so they'll mow the yards, they'll make sure trash is cleaned up. But generally speaking, that is a $500 to $650 payment a month for me on my largest facility that I have.
Yeah, they're not there very often.
Right.
No, that's great. What's been the biggest challenge about the asset class? Can't be perfect. There's tons of positives and they far outweigh the negatives, but what's on the negative side?
So the hard thing is you have like a balance of square foot per capita. So based off data, the state of Texas is 7.74 feet. Like every Texan needs 7 square feet of storage. And so a lot of these facilities are owned by mom and pops or just guys that know how to put metal together. They're like metal fabricators. They'll just put a facility right next to you. And now you have to compete with another 100 units. And they were doing it their own self. You know, like they bought the steel, they put it up themselves. So they're building at 30, 35 bucks a foot. Where like, for me to build, I'm looking at 45 to 50. And then I'm trying to drive revenue, right? I'm like, okay, well, like everyone, you know, we're at 92%. Kind of general rule of thumb is if you're above 90%, you need to raise rents. If you're below 90%, you need to increase your advertising or your marketing. And that 90% is kind of the equilibrium. 85% is what the bank considers stabilized. So you're always wanting to push it just a little bit more. But when you're in a declining population market, which is dangerous for storage, because
for sure,
less people, and then you have some guy that doesn't know any better, maybe he's just trying to, because he's bored, like he adds another 100 unit to the marketplace, that's pretty painful. Some of the way you hedge against that is you buy all the land in the city. And if you can't do that, that was a joke. Some of the way that you hedge for that is just make sure you're buying in a market that has a lot of population growth. And so if there's industry and if there are jobs and there are attractions to move into that area, you're always going to have demand for storage.
Tell me, what's your team look like? What's the structure look like?
Yeah. So like on the private equity, on the like the general partnership side? Or
yeah. Yeah. Tell me, what, when you put a deal together, what's that look like? And maybe from an employee and partner standpoint.
Yeah,
you
know, absolutely. So I had 9 employees with the house flipping business. Mm-hmm. And I am not an integrator. You know, there's 2 types of business owners. This is a visionary and an integrator. I'm a massive visionary. I can tell you where I want to go. I take huge action so I can try to get there. But there's, you know, I'm going to have a lot more failures than not. An integrator is really good at dealing with employees, dealing with procedures and operations, that sort of thing. When I got into storage, I wanted an operations light business. I knew that it was very basic. There wasn't any plumbing. There's sometimes electrical, sometimes HVAC, but most of the time not. I've wanted to keep it as thin as possible. I want to run it like a true private equity company. So a top light side of things, and we consult when we need to. So right now it's just me. We're about to hire an executive assistant because I just can't get to all of the administrative stuff that we need to get to. And I want to make sure that we're covering if a storage facility that is listed or comes across my desk, I want to make sure we're underwriting that sucker and not missing out on any deals. I have a preferred for the syndication docs or the Security Exchange Commission docs. We have a SEC attorney that we deal with here locally, a good buddy of mine. And then we get a property manager out of Illinois mm-hmm. that helps us structure a lot of the stuff. So me and Gary, the property manager out of Illinois, we talk probably once a week. We talk about our facilities, but we also talk about like, where's the market going? Where is the, because he has 65 facilities he gets to take data from and he can communicate like, hey, the state's softening. The state seems to be doing pretty good. But that's about it. I want it as top light as possible. I want a business that offers me the freedom, the most freedom I can get, so I can go mountain biking. Typically on Fridays, which is when we're recording this, I'm mountain biking. I just take the entire day off. I go mountain biking for a few hours and do other things.
Dude, that's amazing. Well, I appreciate you getting this in the schedule here.
I'm honored though. This is great.
All right. So light on the employment side. I know there are a whole bunch of people who from the single family space would love to hear that, that there's an actual asset class that's out there that doesn't require a whole bunch of bodies to be able to get this thing to run.
Right.
Talk to me about, you've got a capital business, I guess, what else are you involved in? And then I want to talk about, you know, where you're headed this year.
Yeah, I've got the private equity company, BalcomiCapital.com. It's BalcomiE Capital. And that's essentially, if you're a doctor, attorney, or something, you want to invest in real estate, but you don't want to learn how to do it, and you don't have time to do it, then you would invest with me. And then that company is slated to do $40 million of acquisitions or development this year. We are breaking ground on our first new construction or our first development of a three-story climate control class A, best in class facility in Georgetown, Texas, which is, it's a subdivision of Austin, Texas. Yeah. Georgetown's grown like 35% in the last 5 years. A healthy growth is 2% a year. So should have grown 10%, grew 35%. That city, from personal knowledge, does not like storage facilities. And to get one permitted is incredibly hard. I've been working on this for 18 months. Yeah. And I'm finally getting to, we file for permits, should happen within a week or two, hopefully. That's a $15 million project. When we're done, when it's stabilized, it should be, if we have a 5-year stabilized value of $31 million, and that's at a 6 cap, which is a little aggressive for guys like us who are still borrowing money from local banks. But for more than likely, that will be a REIT that buys that. They're buying property based off SOFR plus 100 basis points. That would be a 5 cap right now, based off the where that index is. And then that's Q1's purchase. And we just need a couple. Q2, Q3, Q4 will not be new construction. We'll be buying existing assets. Hopefully, as we were talking offline, it's going to be hard to buy when you're borrowing money at 8.5%, 9% on a 20-year note or 25-year note. It's going to be challenging to get these deals done from these older owners who want their nest egg from their retirement. In addition to that, we have, it's called House to Empire. It's basically, I know right now there are a ton of house flippers who thought they could sell a house for $300,000 and that sucker's less than $260,000 and it's just sitting on the market.
Yeah.
There is hope for you. You can get out of that business. Once you get out of that business and you get out of that basically hamster wheel of hell, you can go to housetoempire.com, and it's basically a coaching program where we will take you on and we will teach you how to buy mobile home park, apartment complex, or especially self-storage. And then we will actually partner with you to do those deals. You get to use my balance sheet. You get to use my property management team. You get to use my attorney. And it's a pretty strict requirement. We only take 10 students a year. It's really not a coaching program. And it's really not a coaching program in the sense of like, I want to have 200, 300 people. I'd really want to have 10 new ambitious partners who are wanting to go buy mobile home parks or storage facilities.
That's great. We'll make sure we get all the links put below in the show notes for anybody to be able to find that. Let's do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call 4-4 impact.
4-4 impact.
What's your favorite quote?
I would say it's not really a quote. I actually pulled it up earlier. When everything is falling apart, everything that happened, no matter what it was, I felt like this is going to destroy me. I thought I could make it through, but this is going to take me out. And my buddy, Pat Hyben, he sent me this parable when I was going through this, and it's very stoic. It helps you put everything in perspective. And so I'll just read it to you. Once upon a time, it's called the parable of the Chinese farmer. Once upon a time, there was a Chinese farmer whose horse ran away. That evening, all of his neighbors came around to commiserate. They said, "We are so sorry to hear your horse has run away. This is most unfortunate." Then the farmer said, "Maybe." The next day, the horse came back bringing 7 wild horses with it. And in the evening, everybody came back and said, "Oh, isn't that lucky? What a great turn of events. You now have 8 horses." The farmer again said, "Maybe." The following day, his son tried to break one of the horses, and while riding it, he was thrown and broke his leg. The neighbors then said, "Oh dear, that's too bad." And the farmer responded, "Maybe." The next day, the conscription officers, military officers, came around to conscript people into the army, and they rejected his son because he had a broken leg. Again, all the neighbors came around and said, "Isn't that great? You were so lucky." And he said, "Maybe." The whole process of nature is an integrated process of immense complexity, and it's really impossible to tell whether anything that happens in it is good or bad, because you never know what will be the consequence of the misfortune, or you never know what will be the consequence of the good fortune. And so for me, I can give you a lot of like really, really scary experiences that happened in 2018 and 19. But then I look back, I'm like, I'm so glad those things happened, because now I structure my partnership agreements this way that helped me make more money and give me control of what I was in before. Now I don't buy these types of assets because there's a reason why a house is still in 2008 or 17. You can buy five houses in a certain area zip code for $5,000 each. Yeah. There's a reason. It's because no one wants them. They're not worth it. They're just a big headache. And I know that now, but I didn't. And so I had to go through those things.
That's incredible. What do you think holds most investors back from hitting their personal next level?
I would say fear and limited beliefs. When I did my first syndication, I honestly structured it, the purchase agreement, in a way to not need any partners and also not need any cash from me. So I was basically put, I think it was like $500,000 into the like repair amendment, and then my down payment was $500,000 too. So I was like thinking that it would, and I even talked to the banker. He goes, yeah, we can do that, don't worry about it. And then like it's supposed to close December 30th. On December 21st, he goes, hey, we need $500,000 from you. And I freaked out. I called my business coach and I'm like, I don't know what to do, I don't have it, and like this is the really good deal. And he goes, just raise it. So I spent Christmas that year texting all my friends, and I raised it pretty quick. Like, people believed in me. But if you were to tell me before that, Travis, go raise $500,000 to $1 million, I'd be like, Neil, I can't do that. I mean, that's just, who am I going to call? Like, no one's going to believe in me.
Right.
And so I think what people don't do things because they don't believe they can do it. It's not because they don't believe in themselves. They just don't think they have the resources to do it. In reality, when you push on the universe a little bit, like, no, I'm going to do this no matter what. Even if I fail, I'm going to do it. It's amazing how like you end up getting exactly what you want. I would say that's probably one of the biggest things that keep people from going from like houses to like commercial assets or W-2 job to buying your first residential property. Is there's fear, but there's also like, I'm not worth it, I don't believe that I can have it. You know, and those would be considered limited beliefs.
A lot of times it's not until you have no other choice do you just burst through that made up barrier that was somehow in your mind and then achieve it.
Right. And like when, I can't remember who it was, where I think it was the Pilgrims, they burned the boats. Like now that's like a really common saying. Oh yeah, you just got to burn the boats.
Cortez.
Like,
yeah,
that's right. And there's a lot of truth to that. You're like, we're going to die here or we're going to make it work. Yeah. And like for me, a lot of times I'm like, I'm either going to raise this money or I'm going to lose all my earnest money. I'm okay with that. Or I'm going to either get out of all these houses or they're going to forcefully take them from me as I lay dying, because I'm not going to give them up. I'm referring to back in 2018 ages. So
outside of real estate, what are you most passionate about?
Adventure sports. I like to ski, like snow ski. And then I've already mentioned I like mountain biking. I'm not old, but I'm a lot older than I was 10 to 15 years ago. I used to like to kayak. I have four kiddos. The last time I kayaked was right after my first daughter was born. I got on that white water and I'm like, I can actually die doing this. My daughter will be without a dad. I love adventure sports. I go skiing 2-3 times a year. Hopefully one of these days I will live right next to the resort. Then mountain biking. I love mountain biking. I love to travel going to mountain bike. And then just people. I really like relationships and food.
What's your favorite way to make an impact in the real estate community?
My favorite way? So when I started House the Empire, it's because I was getting calls of people saying, hey, like, what would you do in this situation? Like, do you think I should do this? I think my favorite thing to do is help people. Is like when a buddy calls me and they got a deal, they want me to help underwrite it or that sort of thing, or it's a business. That's my favorite thing. Yeah. And so I would say the thing that makes me most satisfied is probably the way I make the most impact. And that's just through helping others.
For people that want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect with you, where can they go? What should they do?
Yeah. So if you're invested in, or if you're interested in partnering with me, you need to go to housetheempire.com. We have a free ebook that you can download there and get some more information on how we work. Then if you want to invest passively, Balcomie Capital, Balcomie Capital.com is another form on that website you can knock out. Then if you just want to chat with me, you can go to, you can get on Instagram at Travis_Baucom, Baucom. That's pretty much it. Those are three places I hang out the most outside of a mountain. So
yeah, no, that's cool. Travis, I appreciate you taking the time to connect. You've got an amazing story about how, you know, you went from essentially like zero to several hundred homes real quick in the flipping business and then realized, got to a point where that business is a cash monster. Even in good times, it's a cash monster, let alone if the market turns, which it has already for lots of folks. And you hit it on the head. There's a lot of flippers out there in some pain right now, and how it led you to a different asset class, one that is, you're right, is largely recession resistant, right? One of the best asset classes to perform during a recession. You've got an amazing story. So I appreciate you taking the time to connect here.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it.
Thanks so much. For everybody here at Real Grit, I'm Neil Timmons, reminding that real estate requires real grit. See you next time.
If you like our content and want more, you can access it at realgritpodcast.com. You hear it guest after guest. Instinctively, you already know it. But let me call it out. The most expensive action is inaction. The real estate market is full of opportunities. You just need to uncover them. You can build a business that lasts for years, makes monumental impact in the lives of those that you love. It's not just about business, but about the freedom you get because of it. Have you ever heard the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I believe that partnering is essential. In fact, I partner with hardworking investors all the time. The point is that you can get a lot further with the right partner. Let me say it again, the right partner. If you've ever thought about partnering with anyone, or if you have a partner now, I encourage you to download my free Partner and Profit Guide, which includes the top 5 must answer questions to evaluate a profitable partnership. You can find it at www.legacyimpactpartners.com. I'll see you in the next episode.
Hey, it's Neil Timmons. I've got a question for you. Are you a fix and flipper and want to leverage your skills, build passive income, create bigger paydays? Maybe you buy and hold rental houses and you want to increase your income by working less. Maybe you're executing on the Burr methodology and times being what they are, you're finding more cash locked into a deal. Maybe you want more predictable profits, or maybe this is your first go at real estate. Well, I've got a challenge for you. The 20X Profit Challenge. It's hosted and taught by yours truly. I'm going to teach and show you over the course of 5 days in this totally free challenge how to 20X your profit. Lesson one's a game changer, multiplying your income and capital fast. Lesson two is the perfect plan. I'm going to show you how to be getting off-market 20X profit deals coming to you. The cash flow multipliers, lesson three, how to rapidly force appreciation and income growth. Lesson four is the deal accelerator, buying and holding profit guarantee properties. And lesson five, the wealth accumulator, consistently closing a 20X profit deals. I'm going to show you exactly my methodology, exactly what I did to go from where I was at, not achieving the results I wanted to achieve in my life, not achieving that passive income that I hoped for, that I knew I was capable of, and in 3.5 years, becoming financially free. I'm going to do that in a 5-day free challenge. To sign up, go to 20xprofitchallenge.com, 20xprofitchallenge.com. We've got one coming up. Go there now, register. It's totally free. 20xprofitchallenge.com, and I'll see you in the challenge.